Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, we here in Wisconsin are surrounded by rivers. We've got the Mississippi, the Wisconsin River, and I guess the list goes on. But it turns out there are rivers in our atmosphere as well, as we've been learning a bit about in the news in the last several months. And today on the show, the weather guys are with us to tell us more about atmospheric rivers and also why scientists keep track of where lightning strikes and how often and why the heck do they do that. Steve Ackerman with me right now. John Martin, our professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, is teaching a class, but he'll be with us long about noon or so, a little after. But right now, Steve Ackerman is with us, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's also holds a professorship in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And as we talk with Steve, to begin with, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about atmospheric rivers? Maybe you've observed a weird weather condition lately, and maybe you've got some great weather photos, other weather-related, climate-related questions. Hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Steve Ackerman, welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Larry. This is my favorite time of the month.
Well, I tell you what. We have, now here we are with looking at -2 in southern Wisconsin tomorrow. But, I mean, for the most part, southern Wisconsin at least has experienced a pretty mild January.
Yeah, I think up until this cold outbreak we just had, you know, Madison in southern Wisconsin was like almost 10 degrees above normal in terms of its temperature. It's been a really warm January. And, you know, that's switched really quickly, and it'll be cold for the next week or so.
Yeah. Is it concerning when we get us, you know, I have 10 degrees warmer?
Oh, it is when we're averaged throughout the month 10 degrees warmer, because that's just not used to the type of climate that we get here, or the vegetation that we get here, or the water levels that we get here with that kind of warm temperature. So getting this really nice cold air break is something that, you know, if you've lived in Wisconsin for a few years, you've experienced in the past, and we've, you know, gotten used to. And some really like it. It was beautiful this morning. Really, it was -3 in my house. So cold, but it was calm, and, you know, a blanket of snowfall. It was really pretty.
It was, and I got out for my little jog around the neighborhood this morning, and it didn't seem too bad.
It didn't seem too bad, but, you know, I pulled my car out of the driveway, and then I forgot something, so I ran into the garage, and, you know, in that little time it took me to get into the garage and go out, the garage heater turned on, you know, which is, like, really rare because we have it set at 40. It's like, why?
So it's something – I guess that's something you get warm weather like that, and we've certainly been talking climate change and all that. So it's something you keep your eye on.
Yeah, we keep our eye on it a lot, and also up until – this big snowfall, you know, snowfall has been just a little bit below average, and now we're above average, which is good because, you know, the warm winter weather with lack of precipitation, you know, really means there's going to be an impact in the springtime with regard to water level and things like that.
My snowblower broke down yesterday.
It just so happened 2 weeks ago I had got my snowblower fixed.
You found a place to get it fixed.
I found a place to get it fixed. Took them 3 weeks to get it fixed, but they did it, and I got it just before this one. Oh. But I noticed it's leaking oil, which is also annoying. So I don't know what that means.
Well, if there's anybody who knows a repair place on Madison's east side, this is a really...
That's right. As my neighbor said, something needs to be tightened.
Well, we can talk some more about the mild January, and it's hard to talk about it when you've got the cold snap that we've got right now. But lightning is another thing I wanted to bring up for discussion, you know. Last year, scientists were keeping track of where lightning struck.
Yeah.
And how often. And why is that important to track?
So it's a, you know, there's a system that was set up many years ago for a ground-based system. And part of that is not just for tracking and seeing how things change, but also for forecasting. You know, so you know a thunderstorm is moving into your area. And maybe, I don't know, maybe close to a decade now, we also put lightning detectors on satellites now. So we get a much clearer view and a broader view of where lightning is occurring. And that means thunderstorms, right? That's heavy convections. And so that's one reason why we track it, both tracking the thunderstorm, but also lightning. Boy, when it hits something, you know, you can really do some damage to electrical transformers, to electricity in houses and things like that.
Just had a show on last week about impact in rainforests.
And
what happens with lightning strikes and the lightning tends to hit the tallest
trees,
but they're also, those trees are not as affected as the trees around it oftentimes. They live through it because they tend to be hardwood, I mean really harder wood.
Oh, interesting.
And the trees that, you know, of course they're all interconnected with roots and so through the root system, but the shorter ones are, if they're not as powerfully built.
And lightning bolt can jump from one object to another. You know, as we mentioned, John's teaching a class right now. And when I used to teach that class, I mean, when we got to thunderstorms, I would, you know, as part of a class activity, have people tell their stories, experiences with lightning. And it was fascinating because they would tell stories where you could, you know, a bolt of lightning. Fortunately, every story that I had, nobody was really seriously hurt. Usually just knocked off the ground, but you know, they tell stories where it just jumps from one area to another. It sounds like it's the same thing. You can hit a tree, it's going to travel down the tree, down to the root system, and then spread out.
Yeah, and there would, and somebody called and said there was here in Wisconsin where a lightning hit and a tree, and then looking around, there was a. They even found a dead fawn that had been laying on the ground, whereas the plants along the tree were not that were on the tree because they weren't on the ground.
You know, I'm thinking now of one of the stories that one of my students told was he during this discussion, he asked if a single bolt of lightning could kill 20 cattle, and cattle are very sensitive to lightning, which was still a surprise for me. But, you know, I had asked him, so, yeah, I guess, where were they? And he said they were under a tree. So, you know, so it was raining. They went under the tree. Lightning hit the tree, set it out across the roots, and killed 20 cattle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Steve Ackerman, our guest, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. So now some of this research has been going on for 10 years, you said?
Yeah, we have a nice data set now, both from the satellite and even the ground-based measurements, I think, are even longer.
So are there some areas that get more lightning than others, and maybe even has it changed over 10 years?
Yeah, so Florida, as you might expect, gets a lot of lightning for where it is. It's Texas also gets a lot, you know, Mississippi. Wherever you're going to have that hot, humid summer and thunderstorms, that's where you're going to get most of your lightning. There was a recent study that came out. On average, we get, I think it's 20 to 25 million bolts of lightning hitting the ground every year. 2022 was kind of an odd year in that the number of lightning strikes was about the same, but the distribution was really different. So the Midwest, for example, didn't get that many as it normally does. And what they were, I think what that's, study was showing was, and if you might remember, even in the summertime in the Midwest by us, there was a high pressure system sitting over a lot of the area. And so high pressure systems reduce convection because the air is sinking downwards and you want to get an upward motion to generate a thunderstorm.
Well, here we've got atmospheric rivers too, which, you know, I've got to tell you, I can't remember, and maybe, you know, my mind, my memory isn't always the best, but I don't remember hearing a whole heck of a lot of talk about atmospheric rivers until this year.
Until you get the big floodings, you know. But the researchers and the professional meteorologists, we've been talking about atmospheric rivers for decades, because it was a very interesting way of transporting moisture in the upper atmosphere from the Pacific around Hawaii to the West Coast. And then if the conditions are just right, you can get a lot of precipitation, as we've seen in flooding. I always thought it was a weird, odd term, you know, because as meteorologists, atmospheric rivers, you know, well, you know what that is. But if you stop and think about the phrase, you know, we use the concept of a river just because of how much moisture it's carrying. But it's not a physical river, you know, in terms of liquid water moving around.
Yeah. And I was just reading, I was in the Washington Post, had a piece, and probably elsewhere as well, about the fact that the states on the West Coast haven't done enough forethought into capturing that water or protecting
land. When they have droughts in there, you want to capture that water to prevent the droughts. The good news, I guess, is because of this precipitation, there's been a lot of snowfall in the mountains, and that's going to help with the dropping levels of Lake Mead, I think it is, and Colorado River. That's the good news, but they got to figure out how to, you know, stop drawing it all down that in another couple of years we have low levels again.
Yeah, we can talk some more about that, and of course we'll take your questions as well as we move along today. We're visiting with Steve Ackerman right now. John Martin will be joining us in a couple of minutes. Right after we take a look at the news, you'll be able to join back in. You can call right now if you want and get in line. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Back right after the news. Great to have you along today. The weather guys are back with us today. John Martin will soon be here. He's a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. He teaches a class that gets out at around 10 minutes to, and he's got to walk over to the station, and so that's why he's a little late coming, but that's okay. He'll be with us. Steve Ackerman is with me in the studio right now, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. And I hope you'll join in with your weather questions. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Dean in Colorado, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm happy to be able to catch your program. I first caught you guys in August when visiting my son in Milwaukee. I'm in Colorado. That's our home. And it has taken till now to finally catch up with the fact that we're 1 hour difference in time zones. I keep missing your show. So happy to be able to tune in and talk with you guys. I was just relating to the your receptionist that when I was an undergrad student, I remember these atmospheric rivers being a big role, especially during El Nino years, into Southern California, flowing up into the Midwest. I was at Rutgers at the time, but these old satellite images, this was back in the 70s, had a big impact on me, seeing that flow of water streaming up and having a big impact on wintertime precip. You know, one of the things I wanted to catch up with somebody that has more operational knowledge, I went off into research after that into climate change related issues. But I haven't heard as much of an El Nino impact as we had in those 70s and into the 80s. I just wondered if I might hear some comments on that.
Sure thing. Thanks, Dean.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing that you bring that up because this was the, and you know, I should have checked this before I came on, but This is the third year in a row where we were having La Nina conditions. At least that was the case in the fall. I haven't checked if we're at that stage now. It's definitely connected in terms of where the atmospheric rivers flow with regard to La Nina. And you're right, when the satellites came on in particular, which would have been more in the 80s is when we got instrument on the satellites to measure the amount of water vapor in the upper atmosphere. And that's where a lot of research was done on the atmospheric river concept, because you can really see it flow around. And at that time, I was actually in Colorado as well, at Colorado State, doing research in a different area. But yeah, with the water vapor channels in particular, you can really see the circulations in the upper atmosphere. It made it really clear where these rivers occur and how they're moving.
So is El Nino responsible, or La Nina ever responsible for these rivers?
I wouldn't call it responsible, as connected.
Okay.
And so you're going to get that, you know, part of that pattern is just going to bring that kind of water vapor over to the West Coast, which leads to the floodings and usually drying around us, too.
Yeah. There you go, Dean. Yeah. And thanks a lot for calling and listening in. Appreciate your call very much. Well, Jeff in Superior has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I listened earlier in the program, and you were suggesting, which is something I've believed for a long time, that the weather can affect our future clean energy ideas. And I have a robust scenario to present to you, and you can tell me if it's feasible. I think that in the future, a home could utilize geothermal energy for heating and cooling, I guess, in the summer. I guess it works both ways.
It does, yep.
Yep, and you could use solar panels to recharge your independent grid, you know, in your house, and could have an electric vehicle. And you could also have a turbine, perhaps, in your house, a wind turbine that could harness that energy. But I was thinking, as you were talking earlier about lightning, is there any way to harness lightning as a source of clean energy?
Boy, not at this time. And that's just because it's just so much energy in a short amount of time. Now, in the future, there may be ways to set up networks. So you would need a way to distribute where that, you know, how that energy gets distributed and stored. You know, right now it's so much energy coming at once. A lot of times it just leads to destruction rather than storage. So I don't know of any. There may be work out there that's looking at that, but I'm not aware of any.
You'd think that, I mean, you're identifying right now, we're identifying where we get the most strikes.
Right, yep. And so, like, Florida would be a place to do that. Of course, they get a lot of solar energy in general anyway.
But it hasn't been done yet.
Yeah,
we're talking
I don't know if anybody has used lightning as a way to...
John Martin joining us now.
I think it's too much power at short interval, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for that question. Appreciate
something
it.
Something to think about, though.
John Martin, welcome, by the way. Thanks for... teaching your class and coming over and being with us.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm glad to be here. It's been a while, and it was the first sunny day in January, as far as I can recall.
First below zero temperature day as well, right?
Pretty wild out there. Worse tomorrow, though.
Yeah, worse tomorrow. Steve in Houston, Minnesota has a question. Let's go there.
Hi, I'm a real fan, and I look forward to hearing the weather guys, but I wonder if you'd give me a couple of minutes for a spot of criticism.
Sure.
A couple shows ago, there was a Debbie from Winona who called in, and to use a pun, you kind of blew her off on the amount of winds being more prevalent and stronger. And I saw an article on January 8th in the Minneapolis Tribune that says the National Weather Service recorded more days of high winds and gusts in each of the last 4 years than any other period in recent history. And 2022 topped them all, setting a new record for the most gusty days. Wind gusts exceeding 30 miles per hour occurred every other day in 2022 on average. Now, they had, historically, they used to monitor on the top of the federal building in downtown Minneapolis. They moved it out to the airport, and they also switched from the cup style, wind measurements to the ultrasonic. So that probably has increased their accuracy, because the cup styles had ice and snow build up on them.
Yeah, for sure. But, well, what about Steve's comment?
Yeah, first comment, if we gave the appearance of blowing somebody off, we really apologize for that, because that is certainly not our intent.
Yeah.
I sort of remember looking at images of wind speed for southern Wisconsin, and the average wind speed was going up with time. But I don't remember what the situation was for gusts or things like
that. Yeah, I don't think I know the gust information at all. And was this at one place? It's every other day over 30 miles per hour?
Yeah.
Oh, he's gone.
They're not specific as to that. I don't know if that would be just the Minneapolis airport. I know that. I know also that the airport gustiness at Minneapolis was matched by Duluth and St. Cloud.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
And you raise a good point about the changing of how we measurement. And that happens with a lot of measuring systems. We get more advanced and they're more durable.
And more accurate.
Yeah, but then they introduced the problem of how do you standardize against what you used to do.
Right.
So that makes the long-term trends difficult to discern sometimes.
Yeah. Steve, thanks. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Martin in the Driftless area emailed us, and I saved that email for when John would get here so that you
no
could
good.
Both. So you both
it's a tough question, hopefully.
No, you both have a chance to comment on it. I thought it'd be nice to have you both comment on it. And he says, what are the remaining big unanswered questions in meteorology?
We can make a shorter list by saying, what are the ones we think we figured out?
Yeah.
There's tons of them. I mean, I'll just give you a few that are in my mind. I don't really know what the relationship between the upward vertical motion as a storm gets organized and its drop in sea level pressure. And you'd think that would be the most straightforward relationship, but it is nearly impossible to get a really good answer on that. And, in fact, to my experience, it has been impossible. But it seems so fundamental. So that's just one. I don't know why the 850 millibar cold pool in the wintertime is so different from one year to the next and yet has a systematic downward trend. I don't understand that. It seems kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think the thing that really I think of as you ask this question is, recently with the snowfall predictions that we got, the difficulty in accurately predicting how much snowfall we're going to get in a particular locale.
Yeah.
And that's coupled with cloud physics, but also dynamics.
Yeah, that's right.
And the models.
That's right.
I was also thinking the two-week forecast, but that's kind of like, that's a challenge, but it will always be a challenge.
And this was one of those ones, the recent snow was one of those ones where it violates my rule of accuracy, which is if you can accurately paint the complexion of the day a couple of days in advance, you really shouldn't complain too much if it doesn't have too much impact. But this one, I didn't, at least for me, I mean, I don't know if the professionals did or not, but I'm not a professional forecaster, but I sure didn't see 9 inches of snow coming Saturday, especially the second round in Saturday afternoon and evening.
I kept thinking the same thing. I would go outside, we were at a curling bonch bill, and it'd be snowing, and I'd be going, snowing? will you stop?
Yeah.
When's it going to stop? This isn't going to be 3 inches. It's going to be 8 inches.
Yeah, and I'm not complaining, as you probably know.
Well, I complain.
But it was a surprise to me. Yeah.
Well, we had an email that Brock sent, and Steve, you had a look at it. I think you have it on your email as well, from Clara.
Yeah.
And it's a picture of hail. He says hail. And he asks, can you explain how hail can be so oddly shaped? Some had a spike on just one side. And this, the piece that he's holding in his hand, it almost looks like a small arrowhead.
Oh, yeah. I've seen a lot of, well, not a lot, but I've seen enough odd-shaped hail pieces that are really interesting. Usually they're much bigger than the picture that he sent. And what happens is once that hailstone falls, that's what the chunk of hail is called, as it drops through the atmosphere, it starts warming up. And so you get liquid water forming on the surface, and that kind of spreads around and then can generate these spikes on the back. Sort of, you can imagine in a vortex or in a cartoon when they throw the snowball, it just has shedding that occurs that then refreezes. What surprises me about this one is it's clear ice.
Yeah.
And hailstones generally trap air bubbles, and so it's usually not clear.
This might be part of that crown that can develop on the upwind side
that's
as you're going
could
down.
Could be a piece of one.
And a piece of it fell out. Yeah, that's the thing about when you get an odd-shaped hailstone, it's always interesting. But you have no idea what exactly is the history of that hailstone that you have in your hand. And that's one really good idea that you have right there.
And actually, I'm now thinking that sometimes with the bigger hailstones, you'll see rings in them. So it'll be cloudy, clear, cloudy, clear. Mm. And those clear ones, they freeze really quickly.
Yeah.
So you don't have time to trap air bubbles.
Yeah.
And again, this is a smaller one, so maybe it froze quickly. But then why would you get a tail if it's freezing so quickly?
Yeah, it's interesting.
I think this is a new list of things I don't understand.
Yeah, there you go, right. The question I'd have is, were there bigger hailstones in the vicinity?
That's the only hailstone.
One to think about. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to Bill in Green Bay next. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon, Larry. Another great show. Thank you very much. Question I had is if you could comment on future or near future weather patterns as they might affect the water levels on the Great Lakes. I have a sailboat up in Door County. And I have a rather deep draft, so I'm a little concerned about the trends for water levels on the bay and Lake Michigan.
Mm. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, we've been confronted with this question as non-experts for three decades now. And one of the things that's been alerted in my mind is the fact that it's really ice cover in the winter that determines to a first order whether or not the lakes are going to lose or gain water, aside from the use that population centers make of them. And I think 2013 and 14 were a couple of good examples of that. It was really chilly around here. And 95% ice cover on Michigan, I think, and some large fraction on Superior. And the lakes didn't lose much water because they don't get replenished much by the fact that they have extremely small watersheds. It has to rain within, I think, 50 miles or so of the coast
the watershed's
on average.
Really small.
It's extremely small. So you're not feeding the lakes by rivers that are really distant or anything like that. So it's really, I think, a couple of things that are at first order. But one of them is ice cover. And this year is probably going to be a bad year for losing water.
Yeah, they were just talking about that in terms of freight.
There
are longer period of time where they can haul freight on Lake Michigan.
Mm. Well, but if the water level's dropping, then...
Yeah, so it's sort of a combination of things, but the point is that there's less ice.
Yeah, yeah, man.
Bill, there you have it. And it's interesting that the water is replenished from only about 50 miles from the lake.
It's just amazing. I couldn't believe when I first saw that.
I was really surprised, too. I mean, the rate we get here in Madison isn't going there.
Yeah, right.
It's going to the Mississippi.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, that's
amazing.
Yeah.
Bill, thanks very much. Appreciate your call. Rich in Green Bay, it's your turn.
Hi. Yeah. At the end of December, I was camping in Arkansas.
Uh-huh.
And it was a waxing crescent moon, light cloud cover. You could even see a few stars. But there was a huge concentric ring around the moon of clear sky. It stayed around until the moon went, over the horizon. You have any idea what that was?
Hmm. Wow. No, not, I wouldn't, a ring of precipitation, not of cloud we usually see, or it's an optical effect where you can see the ring because of the scattering of the moonlight off of ice, a very thin ice cloud or very thin stratus.
No, but something that occurs to me is that since it's at night, and is it true, Steve? I can't remember. The light that's refracted through the ice is there's a deficit of light around the glowing object.
That's
and
true.
It
looks
lighter
darker
on the outside.
That's right. You see that with the halos around the sun in particular.
So maybe it was just a little bit darker enough in a very thin halo, a very thin cirrus deck, that it looked like it was clear. It's possible.
That
you
could
think?
Be. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because inside the halo, there's less light because the light is scattered out of the center of the circle. So that could have been a bit of an illusion that way. Yeah. It's very
interesting. That's easy to see when you have a daylight with the sun and a halo around the sun.
Right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. That sky right around it is definitely bluer, darker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Rich, there you go. We got. I hope that helps. Appreciate
that's
your
weird
call.
Yeah.
And somebody else... Jim says, wonders why atmospheric rivers, or do atmospheric rivers have an effect on the weather here in the Midwest?
Sometimes they do. Atmospheric rivers are just plumes of low-latitude moisture that get caught up in the circulation of extratropical weather systems. They are very high-profile in the state of California because they features like them involved in extratropical storms deliver about 50% or more of the precipitation for the whole state in a given year. So they really matter in California. Here we get a whole bunch of other variety of types of disturbances that can bring us weather. But once in a while, we get something that looks just like it. We don't have the long fetch to the tropical Pacific that the state of California yeah. does, but we sometimes have a pretty good fetch of moisture off the Gulf of Mexico that can give us a pretty good event. Mm-hmm. One of my graduate students did a paper on the Nashville flood in May of 2010, and that was undoubtedly something like an atmospheric river. The more interesting stuff to us was the dynamics, but it's definitely got you know, a similarity to these.
So features. The moisture was pumped up from the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, and the long axis of the Gulf of Mexico. So they had an incredible flood. The Grand Ole Opry was half destroyed. Yeah. That was a really major flood in Nashville.
And we had so the flooding that we had. When was it?
When
I'm trying to think of when the flooding in southern Wisconsin, where like Lake Mendota was.
August 2010.
I think it was August or 2009.
Yeah, it was
Might
one of those
2009.
Years. That was an extra. That was a tropical cyclone that kind of decayed as it moved northward and got ingested into an extratropical disturbance. But it did the same type of thing that these atmospheric rivers do, which is bring water vapor content that you don't usually see at these latitudes way far north and be involved in heavy precipitation. So yeah, I don't think the atmospheric river people would say that's one of it would be an example
river,
of one.
Right. It's just
but there's
water
some
vapor
similarities.
Transport. Yeah.
So, and here's another one. How does sea ice change with the seasons?
Ooh.
Gladys wants to
It know. Grows in the winter and shrinks in the summer.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Well, there's two types, really. There's a real difference between sea ice growth and shrinkage in the North Pole versus the South Pole, right? Because the South Pole, you have Antarctica is covering that entire South Pole. So you're really just looking at the sea ice around the Antarctic continent. And some of that also is different in that it's driven by the glaciers on the Antarctic continent. So they slope down every now and then. You know, it's pushing the ice out onto the ocean, and then it gets too far out. Something happens, and it breaks off, and you have a rapid change due to breakage. Whereas in the North Polar regions, a lot of the sea ice is due to warming of the waters that are occurring up there.
Yeah, and you don't, you know, they have, I saw a map recently, four-year-old ice versus one-year-old ice in terms of the thickness is incredibly different. And there's an increasing fraction of one-year-old ice at the beginning of every winter. Yeah. Or at the beginning of every spring. And the consequence is that just doesn't last through the summer. And so you're constantly pushing back the edge of what's the year-round sea ice in the North Pole.
Yeah.
Bad news.
Yeah, bad news. There's been some research on that where they've been going underneath the ice layer. And there's a river of water.
Yeah, warm water underneath.
Water underneath the ice flow that is creating some problems that we're going to have to talk about the next time we're on the air because we're out of time. Always a pleasure, guys. Thanks so much, Steve and John. Appreciate it very much. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, they'll be back the last Monday of next month, and we'll do it all over again with them. And just to quickly let you know, tomorrow on the show, we have Jerry Apps talking about his new book, and then we'll catch up on some stories from around the state with the editor of Our Wisconsin Magazine. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.